Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining the Fulbright webinar presentation today. We offer an ongoing series of webinars throughout the competition cycle on a variety of topics, and today we have the pleasure of hearing from two alumni who recently did their grants in sub-Saharan Africa. So we have one person who went to Zambia and another person who went to South Africa. My name is Megan Anthony, you can call me May, and I'll be hosting today's presentation. I manage outreach and recruitment for the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program to Sub-Saharan Africa at the Institute of International Education in Washington, D.C. My job is to really help you navigate the application process. Please note that the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program is aimed at U.S. citizens, scholars, and professionals. If you are a student, recent graduate, or a non-U.S. citizen, I'd recommend looking at our website to find the Fulbright that's right for you. So I will first start with a really brief overview of the Fulbright Scholar Program and then spend the majority of the time hearing from the alumni and answering any questions that you have. If you would like a more thorough overview of the program to Sub-Saharan Africa or any of our other Fulbright Scholar opportunities, please take a look at our website. We have a section of recorded webinars. And as a note as well, this webinar, if you can't stay for the whole time or if you'd like to look at the PowerPoint later, will be recorded within 5 business days. So next week, it should be online. So the Fulbright program has been around for about 75 years. It's a program that values academic achievement, but it's really about people-to-people diplomacy. It's sponsored by the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Department of State. And it's funded through an annual congressional approval process, as well as funding from our foreign partners. It enjoys strong bipartisan support. There are several Fulbright programs. Off the top of my head, I can think of at least 7. And the goal is mutual exchange with all of them. The Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program, which is the program that we're focusing on for this webinar, is for academics and professionals to teach and conduct research abroad in over 125 different countries. We offer about 50 awards to Africa, to 27 countries within Sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm not going to talk about all of the opportunities today, but I will briefly talk about how to find the opportunity that's right for you if you're still in the stage where you're not quite sure what you would like to apply for. I did get a ton of questions beforehand. Thank you so much for sending those in. And I know that some of you are in the process of trying to find collaborators, while others of you are deciding on your project or putting the finishing touches on an application. This conversation today, which I really see as a conversation, will kind of address any questions relevant to you, whatever stage in your application. And if we don't have enough time to get to all of your questions, then we can connect over email at a later date or set up a phone consultation. So as you'll see from this slide here, the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program does have some eligibility requirements. The full list is online, but U.S. citizen and degree requirements are listed on our website. So the way it works is that we have about 500 award opportunities, as I mentioned, about 50 for Sub-Saharan Africa, and each award will specify the degree that they require. About 80% of our awards require a PhD, but you can search our catalog of awards. If you don't have a PhD, or if you are not sure what a terminal degree is for your background, I'm more than happy to talk to you about it as well. So as I mentioned, these awards are teaching and research focused. If you are looking to pursue any type of education, we do have the Fulbright U.S. Student Program, but the point of the Scholar Program is really to bring your expertise and share it with institutions abroad. We work a lot with universities through this program, but you could also engage with a variety of institutions like NGOs or research institutions. The awards are 3 to 9 months in length, or 3 to 12 months in length, my apologies, although we do have one award to Israel, I know, that's about 2 years a month. And as mentioned, it's not just open to academics, although some awards do require teaching experience at the university level, and you really have to look at each award to see what it requires. We did get a question beforehand from someone who is celebrating his 70th birthday. Congratulations, by the way. Asking if there's an age requirement and or an age limit, and there's absolutely not. So we do see applications from individuals who are retired and don't have a host institution or who are in the later stage of their life apply to this program, as well as postdoctoral candidates who just received their PhD. So there are really opportunities for everyone. And it's important to just look at our catalog of awards and find the opportunity that's right for you. And on this next slide here, I have some highlights for Africa. So as I mentioned, we just have so many awards to Africa, and the focus of this webinar is really to hear specific questions from you as well as just a conversation with our alumni. But this can give you an idea of some of the opportunities we have. I had another person ask about our research opportunities. The Africa Regional Research Program is one of our main research opportunities, and it's actually this program as well as the awards to South Africa are the only ones that offer research only. There's just such a strong need for teaching in the region that's expressed by the U.S. embassies. So the as you look to see, like, if you're, you might be thinking, who is putting these awards together, how does that process work? It's really a collaboration between the U.S. Embassy and the Department of State that's also reviewed by IIE, but the U.S. Embassy and country will outline their needs. So as you can see, some awards, like African Regional Research Program, are open to people of all disciplines. Other ones, like Mauritius and Zimbabwe, specify that they're really looking for someone with a very specific background. And we also have awards like the award to Zambia, which is looking for people in a variety of fields, like international relations, accounting, political science, and so on. And they will give priority to applications in the fields that they've outlined. So here I've just given you some information about the awards. You know, it's, I can't go into detail about all of them at this time, but as you can see, like, a lot of them are longer term. For some of them, you do need proficiency or some understanding of another language, and you'll see that the activities vary as well. So some of them will offer teaching research, some will be research only, some will be teaching only. There are quite a variety of options, and we generally say there is a Fulbright for you. It's just a matter of finding it and doing a little bit of homework about that. And then once you've found the catalog, once you found the award you're interested in, it's about talking to people in country, finding a collaborator in country, whether it's at an institution of higher education or another kind of institution. And this next slide here, we'll talk about some of the resources that we have to offer. So we do, we list on our website all of the components of the application. Just to keep it brief, I will just say with the letter of invitation, because we get so many questions about that. We may hear from our panelists about it, but we do, if you're in the process of just finding a collaborator and you don't know where to start, we recommend looking at university websites, reaching out to people in your network, as well as looking at the catalog of awards, as it might have recommendations. And if you've done all that and you don't know where to go next, you can also reach out to me, and I can reach out to the U.S. Embassy on your behalf and see if there's anything that they recommend. And here are some additional resources, like the Catalog of Awards, which has all of our 50 award opportunities to Africa, guidance on application, sample project statements, the webinar link that I talked about, and a link to blog post. And again, this will be recorded and archived online. Great. So now I do want to start talking with the alumni. I see that right now online we just have one of them, but I think we can still get started with that. So we have Dr. Tanja Karp, and I hope that Dr. Henning is also able to join us in a little bit, but I know she was finishing up a class. But Dr. Tanya, could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your academic background and area of expertise and how and why you decided to apply to the Fulbright program.
Sure, May. Thanks so much. So I was in South Africa. Well, I am. Let's stop there. I'm currently an associate professor for electrical and computer engineering at Texas Tech University. And my focus is on engineering education. And at Texas Tech, I work a lot with teachers and schools to promote STEM education. And I organize a robotics competition that aims at engaging young students into the STEM disciplines by participating in that competition. So for my Fulbright, I really wanted to do something related to that work. And I actually always wanted to apply for a Fulbright. When I was a graduate student back in Germany, I saw the flyers at my university. At that time was like the student program to go to the US. And I always thought like, well, that's impossible to get. And eventually, like a classmate of mine a year below got a Fulbright and went to the U.S. and returned and talked about her experience. And I thought, well, God, okay, I missed that chance. So after my PhD, I went to the U.S., to Texas Tech. And then for a couple of years, I wasn't eligible for a Fulbright because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. So I felt like, oh, this is too bad. But I always was involved in the program being a Fulbright advisor for our student program and being on the committee. So how did I end up applying for a Fulbright? Well, it was in the back of my head. It was something I wanted to do, and it was something I wanted to be special. I knew I didn't want to go to a European country that I could go and visit, but I wanted this Fulbright to be something special that I will remember for the rest of my life and something I wouldn't have done otherwise. So back in 2013, at a conference on community engagement, I talked about my robotics program and the STEM community engagement, and I met a lady from South Africa, from the University of South Africa. And we immediately connected because she did something very similar. So kind of like during the whole conference, we talked, and I told her about what I was doing and how the program that I'm running at Texas Tech would be beneficial for the youth in South Africa. And she talked about her programs, and we actually stayed in touch and started a pilot project, an international robotics competition, the year after, and seeing that we really were kind of like on the same page and worked well together, I eventually asked the question, so how would you feel about me coming to South Africa and being a Fulbright scholar? So she first had to look up what the Fulbright program was, and I sent her some information there, but basically and it took me like 2 years, two application processes. The first time the application was rejected, but the second time I got that Fulbright. And we found that mutual program and project that we were both interested in. And since we made like face-to-face connections earlier, that the communication was so much easier than trying to find a collaborator at a university where you don't know anybody. So I spent 11 months in South Africa. I took my two teenage children with me. They went to school there. And I, my husband was also fortunate enough that he was able to teach online. And so the whole family went, and we spent nearly a year over there. On the research side, my first semester really was looking into what's going on already. I had that idea, and part of the proposal was to implement a new robotics competition to engage in STEM in South Africa. That's at a beginner level, but I wanted to be sure through experience that it's really something they needed. And one of the great things with the Fulbright program is that Fulbright acknowledges this flexibility. Well, you have like a great proposal, but the moment you go, things might work out differently. But actually, I got to know nearly everybody involved in STEM education, and particularly engineering education among elementary middle school students. I got connected with the Department of Science and Technology over there, the Department of Basic Education. I had projects that I did together with the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria. And just kind of like being in the capital, being stationed there for me was a big difference because there was so much more visibility on all the initiatives that we did, and there were so many more like foundations and NGOs that were interested in what we were doing compared to being in West Texas. So kind of like getting my foot into the door, participating in ongoing activities, and getting a feeling for the country was the first semester, and then the second semester we actually did implement that the part of the project that I had in mind, like a beginner's competition. On the teaching side, it was a little more tedious because there was, despite having made like connections early on and we planned for success and submitted paperwork early for teaching new classes, they weren't in their catalog until the second semester. So in the first semester, I did informal teaching. We had a group of university students who were interested in learning about robotics. They were mostly engineering students, but they came also from other disciplines. And we hosted weekly classes, workshops for them, and got them up to speed to where afterwards they would assist us going to schools and working with teachers and providing that local face to our community engagement efforts. And then in the second semester, I taught an online class. Well, the University of South Africa is this 100% distance education school, so all their classes were online. So I developed a robotics class mainly for coaches and teachers, kind of like non-degree seeking students, as part of the community engagement mission that the university has over there, and taught that class with online lectures, feedback, weekly seminars, and so forth. I think that's kind of like a first overview.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We did have someone reach out and ask if teaching obligations have to be met by teaching regular classes or by teaching, or if someone could offer a series of short-term courses and mentoring of graduate students and faculty and research. So it sounds like you kind of answered that question because some of your work was more formal, but at the beginning your work was a little bit less structured, but still quite important.
And I was like doing the informal teaching at the beginning helped me also to get a feeling for the skill level of the students over there. I also did advising for university leadership and other type of initiatives where I was just where I was involved with how to do community. The issue they had at the time was like a decreasing budget, so financial constraints. The budget was shrinking and shrinking, kind of like getting ideas on how to do more on a smaller budget, and I was able to help them out with some ideas there.
Great. And Meg, I see that you are also on the call, so we are also joined by Dr. Meg Henning, who did a Fulbright scholarship actually around the same time as Tanya. And Meg went to Zambia. Meg, could you talk a little bit about your background and area of expertise and how you decided to apply to the Fulbright on your end as well?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just great.
Okay, perfect. So I actually, I really appreciate, first of all, hearing about the flexibility piece because I think that that's always key in this work. My experience in Zambia, I'd been to Zambia before. My time was only a semester, so it was a bit shorter. And I know for myself, one of the questions that came up for me was, is it appropriate to be going to a country where I have some experience? And the feedback I got was that it was, and I'm really glad that I did have that experience because I was able to do the work that I had intended to do and proposed to do in a short time. And I think it would have been hard otherwise because it takes a while to kind of figure out who to connect to and the process and the country and the culture. And I think there's a lot of change that's going on all at once. Just to give you a little bit of background, my work is in leveraging community health assistance into the system of care to support maternal child health. So I had to do a lot of traveling. I did bring my family and my two kids, who my daughter is 3 and my son was 9, and so our daughter went to a local preschool and our son went to the international school, so I can also answer and speak to his experience or our experience as a family, and my husband was with me. So he was took care of the kids a lot while I traveled quite a bit throughout the country, 14, 15 hours outside the city on long roads to reach health centers in rural Zambia. And some of the other projects, I did not do teaching. I did come in and do some lectures. I also had the wonderful opportunity sort of that evolved once I was there from the work. And it was a great opportunity because I got to meet folks who had common interest in working with community health assistants, and we'd only read each other's articles. And so this opportunity allowed me to come together with other faculty at the University of Zambia who had common interest as mine, and really have some protected time to work together, build a relationship. We're still working together. We've published 2 papers. We're still in contact. But the other piece that I wanted to be sure to mention was that we also started working on an undergraduate program in health promotion. And that came out of their need, having me there, and we're still working on that now. So it's really exciting, I think, to stay open to the opportunity, sort of have what you want to do planned, and have an idea of what needs there are and how you can contribute, but also being present to what folks in the country are looking for and needing, and is really, really important. I also started, because mine was research focused, I started all of my IRB pieces prior to going to Zambia. So I did a lot of work email-wise. I didn't do all of it, but I did get started with submitting documentations and starting to think about what I was going to do and how that was going to unfold in a way that would make sense time-wise. With my colleagues in Zambia at the university, and thinking about who might be able to come out to the field to help me or kind of point me in the right direction. But I really had to also do a lot on my own and be prepared to do that. And luckily, I think I'm comfortable and was comfortable doing the work that I needed to do. But I was very thankful for my colleagues that pointed me in the right direction or redirected me or made suggestions with who I needed to connect with. So I think I had both the opportunity to work with other faculty and build that relationship. And again, it's wonderful to have WhatsApp because we still can talk to each other throughout the day while I'm in the U.S. and they're in Zambia, and still continue our collaboration. So that's been really great. And I think if you don't have WhatsApp, it's used everywhere, and it's a great tool for just being able to talk to people and still have that FaceTime that's so important. I also, before I finished my project, I presented the initial results back at USAID and the U.S. Embassy. So I was able to share and thank them for their support, the work that I'd done, and give it back to faculty. So I created some time to actually do some formal presentations at the end. So that's a sort of a nutshell of what I was doing.
Fantastic. It's great to hear about your experience. I do want to mention some of the questions that I'm seeing. That first of all, so Dr. Karp did a teaching research project. So she proposed to do teaching when she initially applied. And Dr. Henning, I believe you did a research only project. Just to give you all a sense of their backgrounds as it relates to the program. I think they touched upon it, but I just wanted to make sure as I saw a question come in about it. And I just also want to reiterate Dr. Henning's point about having previous research or previous experience in the area. So this is a question I got a lot, and I actually just got it from an applicant saying, you know, what is the disadvantage or advantage of having previous experience in the host country? So in general, from the Fulbright perspective, as someone who works in outreach Fulbright, the Fulbright program as a whole does give advantage to people who haven't had experience, a lot of international experience, people who haven't had a lot of experience in country. It's the way the program is designed. But for specific regions like Sub-Saharan Africa, it's often much more helpful to have experience in the region, and some of our awards actually do state that they give preference to people who have experience in country. And as you can kind of tell by hearing from these two alumni, meeting people in country or traveling to the region was something that was helpful to facilitate them actually going on a grant, and I'm sure it was also helpful when they were writing their proposals. So, yeah, that's kind of a convoluted answer, but I would say having previous experience in sub-Saharan Africa can be quite helpful. If you are also looking at other regions, then it may or may not be helpful depending on what you see in the catalog of awards. And Meg, we had a follow-up question. Someone wanted to ask if you needed to apply for IRB approval to both institutions, home and Zambia. Could you speak to the IRB process a little bit?
Sure, that's a great question, and I think a lot is contingent on where you're doing your work. I saw advice from the University of Zambia. I did apply, just I felt like it was the appropriate thing to do, and saw guidance from my institution and UNSA. And I submitted an application both at my institution and at the University of Zambia. I also had to get approval from the Ministry of Health, and every district and province that I worked in. So if you, it's a good thing to think about. I don't think, to be honest, until I started doing it, I went, oh my goodness, I didn't realize I'd need quite that many levels of approval. But I am glad I started in advance, because at least when I started, I had the IRB approval. But then when I was on the ground, I would go and introduce myself and get the approval from both provinces where I collected data and districts.
Great, thank you. And Tanya, we have a question about safety in South Africa. Could you speak to the safety in South Africa in general, and specifically this person will be traveling through each province by car?
Okay, so I traveled also with professionally as well as with my family throughout South Africa. The first 2 weeks when I arrived in South Africa, they were really intense. One of the things you do in the first week is you have to go to the U.S. Embassy for a security briefing, and they tell you lots of things you don't want to hear. From videos where they show like car hijacking in the middle of the day in Joburg, they talk about smash and grab. Basically, it's a different culture of what you do and what you don't do in as you drive along in your car. Like every item you have had to go into the trunk. Don't have any bags, whether it's the school bag of the kids or your wallet. Nothing stays kind of like with the passenger in the car, but everything has to go into the boot. You don't see people using their cell phone kind of like as a GPS device on the windshield. There are incidents, there's a lot of traffic in Pretoria, so you really are stuck in traffic at a red traffic light very often. And they talked about leave a car and a half empty space, have an idea if somebody kind of like with a rock smashes or approaches your car and you think they're going to smash the one of the side windows where you would want to escape, those type of things. And I heard about it from colleagues and friends over there. So there's more awareness of crime. We didn't have any incident, but like my colleague, she had an electric gate for on her driveway, and it was always kind of like you open the electric gate, you drive in, you then close the electric gate, and only after the electric gate is closed, you exit your car. In general, so it's different routines, different way of life that you just want to comply with, I think, to not be an easy or naive target. But once I've been there for about a month and also got used to like the left side, driving on the left side of the street, and kind of like got my bearings and knew roughly where I need to go and didn't feel like I was totally lost, it didn't feel any different from driving in the U.S. It's just kind of like a little like, don't do this and don't. I mean, in the U.S., I would say don't leave your valuables in the car parked on the street in front of your house overnight. There, it's just kind of like, even if you drive, don't have your valuables visible. Road quality is really amazing. I drove, I rented a small VW Polo. And it was always like a 3-month rental contract, and then I returned it, and sometimes I got the same car again or another car. But basically, for the whole 11 months, I had several long-term rental contracts. So I drove around in a rental car all the time. And that VW Polo got us everywhere. Once in a while, you end up on a gravel road, but even then, that gravel road is in pretty decent condition. If you want to go to game reserves, wildlife management areas, and observe animals, it's a different story. There you might want to have like a more off-road vehicle for that purpose, but just to get around, that VW Polo got us everywhere. It's also kind of like once you get used to driving on the left side of the street, folks are really helpful drivers. They let you in, they don't yell at you if you make a mistake. So I felt that driving wasn't really stressful.
Thank you so much, Tanya. This is, brings back memories of me driving around in South Africa. So I do want to ask you both a little bit about your experience living in the host country. But first of all, we did have someone who had a question about reaching out to more than one university for a collaboration. So the answer I would give is that it is fine to reach out to more than one institution for collaboration. Some people collaborate with more than one institution, although you just need to be clear about how much time you're spending with each one, or if you are just trying to get a better sense of, you know, what would be a good fit and you're reaching out to different universities, that's fine. The universities also will often sign multiple letters of invitation. But did either of you get multiple letters of invitation? I just wanted to ask to see if you had any specific experience with that.
I did not. I just worked with the University of Zambia for myself.
Great. And Tanya, I think you just worked with the University of South Africa as well, right? Or did you?
That's correct. So it's kind of like, and the other entities I worked with, it was through already existing collaborations at the University of South Africa. So it was through the University of South Africa that we went to like a national science fair and worked with like the South African Agency for Science and Technology Advancement or the science centers, but it all was kind of like exploiting already existing networks, and I always got introduced as their Fulbright scholar. So I only had that one affiliation. I would say just be open. I wouldn't kind of like if somebody doesn't have a letter of invitation yet, you can kind of like look at different institutions once. Just kind of like be open and tell your collaborators what you're up to. Kind of like, I have another opportunity at a second university. How do you feel about we make this a collaborative project, something along those lines?
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like advice you would give as well. Great. So it would be great to get a better sense of just your experience living, both of you, of living in the host country. The questions I have, which feel free to answer whichever one makes the most sense, but, you know, what are the highlights, surprises, challenges? You know, what was your experience like in country? If we could start with Meg, that would be great.
Sure. I had a great experience. I think it was too short. I wish it had been longer. I think I'd been to Zambia before, so I was very comfortable. I kind of knew where I wanted to stay. I think the cost of living always sort of surprises me. I think, like was already mentioned, we rented a car. We were trying to figure out, you're sort of having your daily life of work and kids going to school, and you're doing it in a new place. So you have to acclimate everyone in the family and sort of be in a new work environment very quickly. I think, personally, it was wonderful to watch the children experience a new place and people and cultures, and that is, I think we knew that was going to happen, but to see that play out is wonderful and really immerse, really be in a school and be in sports programs and the shopping for food, all of those little pieces. We were also there, though, I should add, during the start of sort of that cholera outbreak. So it's also recognizing those other health challenges. My son got very sick. We took him to a local clinic for a malaria test while we were there. Luckily, he didn't have malaria, but I think being prepared for life and what that means someplace else and knowing how to respond and where to go. I was, even though I knew Zambia, I did make sure I knew where we would go to a doctor if someone was sick and who could we call, and kind of having that information was really helpful as a family. People were very nice, but we did do a lot of pieces on our own as a family to make sure that we were okay, and such as renting the car and doing some trips to see things. But again, I was traveling a lot, so I sort of actually, that was a bit of a struggle initially for me because I couldn't find a car to rent where they would allow me to go far out into the field because of the roads, and people didn't want their rental cars getting destroyed. So it took me a little while to find a car that I could actually rent where they would let me go farther out. So being aware of those types of things that I hadn't thought of, I sort of assumed if you rent a car, you could go wherever you needed to go, and that's not always the case. I was able to figure it out. But still, I think there's always going to be unexpected challenges. And like anything, when you have kids and family and you're all navigating your daily life, but again, people were helpful, not being afraid to ask questions, not being afraid to try new things, and I think this is mentioned before, but being aware of safety. We didn't go out a whole lot at night. I mean, unless we were traveling or camping, or I was traveling, we tried not to drive long distances late at night. So we did, if we were going to travel somewhere as a family or go to Victoria Falls or something like that, we would go early in the day because it is risky, and driving can be dangerous. A lot of trucks, a lot of cars moving fast. So just being aware of those pieces, I think, are important, as well as your vaccinations and all the things. But Fulbright really prepares you. And I mean, I didn't feel unsafe. I felt comfortable. We had fun. People were generous and kind. We made a lot of friends, both from the international community, local community, university community. Overall, it was a fantastic experience. I'm very thankful for the opportunity.
And what about you, Tanya?
Well, many of the things that Meg said sound very familiar, kind of like I can echo most of it. I'm really, really glad I went for 11 months instead of 6 months. And unlike her, I had no clue about what South Africa would be like. We happened to go to South Africa because I met this colleague who project-wise did exactly what I wanted to do, and it sounded like a great opportunity. So I wasn't really prepared for South Africa, other than what I remembered from like school, like the end of apartheid and Nelson Mandela and democracy. So South Africa never was on our travel list. So we just went and waited to see what's happening. And in 11 months, you see a whole year. And just kind of like from like the seasonal perspective, what plants, what's the weather like, what plants are blossoming in what season, what do people do in that particular season. It was always like the country was full of surprises. My kids didn't want to go, and my kids, so they were like 12 and 15 at the time, and they had their own plans, what they wanted to do, and we said, well, you don't have a choice, you got to come with us. And well, but then again, like, you worry as a parent, like, what if they don't like it? I didn't want it to be an experience that they appreciate like years later. And we got very lucky with the school they enrolled in. It was a mix of a German school and a local, like a German international school, they called it. They had many talented kids from the townships on the U.S. South African curriculum at the school, and then being in the capital, they had also kind of like the diplomat and expat German kids. So it was a great mix that my kids experienced, and everybody there was very helpful, so that they enjoyed it too. And I was just so relieved when it worked out for everybody. But people, my son termed it as, he said, South Africans are insanely polite. People are really helpful. We got invited immediately. We were asked what it would take to help us. We found people kind of like we could ask about, like, what if I need a doctor and travel advice, want to go to this location, how do I drive there, which roads are safe, which are not, is there anything we should or should not see on the way. So from really like a personal perspective, it was amazing. From the university perspective, it was nice, but it was nice since I was a visitor. There's so much logistical chaos and restructuring and reorganization at the University of South Africa that was going on, where I just wasn't prepared for the levels of approvals you need for whatever you're asking for. I wasn't prepared for everything. Like you walk around with a piece of paper and you need 10 different signatures. Half of the folks who need to sign your request don't understand the content, but they still need to sign your request. Lots of political issues, budget issues. So all that was okay to observe. It actually made me feel so much better about my home institution in the U.S. that I would say, like, yeah, for a year it was really nice. But and people fight there. People adopt. They just get it to work despite a lot of the structure not working. So I admire them for all the energy they put into getting things to work, but I'm not sure I would have that energy on a long term if I was kind of like in that system.
And Tanya, we did have a follow-up question specifically for you, which is more just about the institutional work that you did there. Someone just mentioned that they've been told that the classes at the University of South Africa are taught online, and if this is the case, they wanted to know if that in any way diminished your Fulbright experience, given that you could also teach the same class just like from the U.S. So I guess they're wondering, you know, what was the value of being in country to do this work if it potentially could have been done in the U.S.?
It's a good question. So if you just teaching, I wouldn't recommend the University of South Africa if you're looking for a teaching only award, unless you bring expertise that they don't have. In the engineering program, they don't have that many labs. There's the whole structure of like how do you do an online lab. So there's more knowledge, I would say, in distance education in the U.S. compared to the University of South Africa. So I was really happy. I mean, I would say like the teaching part, that online class I taught was the least successful and least rewarding experience throughout the Fulbright, because people were like, they signed up for the class, they were non-responsive, the assignments didn't come in. I had a commitment of providing like 15 weeks of curriculum, but if after week three you don't hear from anybody, it was just kind of like a very passive group of participants in this class, to where I would, and there were structural issues because the class was for teachers mostly, and the University of South Africa started their semester before the teachers started their semester. There were issues with enrollment and payment and access to the class. The whole online environment is very rudimentary. I mean, I use Blackboard in the U.S. where you can upload videos and you can, oh, there's a chat room and there's so many more possibilities there, whereas at the University of South Africa, we were restricted to files not being larger than 10 megabytes, and if we wanted to have a video somewhere, the video had to be, I don't know, hosted on Google Drive, and you just would send them a link. So the teaching part, I was able to tie it in. And so the good part is like we converted that class into a MOOC. We're still working on it. I feel I now have a curriculum developed that reaches an international audience. It allows me beyond the period of that Fulbright grant to continue the work I did and educate teachers in robotics in a format that we now keep improving. And the other thing is kind of like Meg mentioned WhatsApp, that kind of like chat messaging app for cell phones, and that really was like the way to reach people. Reaching an audience by email was difficult. My experience was also like a wireless network at the universities or at the schools that was different. There was kind of like an attitude among the participants in the class that, well, if my school network doesn't work at the moment, the Wi-Fi is down, then I just don't do anything. We always had to kind of like send a WhatsApp message to everybody, hey, we sent an important email, try to check your email and read it carefully. So yeah, if you bring expertise they don't have, that's cool. It wasn't my favorite part of it.
Sure. Yeah, and I would say, you know, a lot of these universities, not just in South Africa, are looking for scholars to help strengthen existing programs or bring expertise that they don't have already. Which is why you'll see such a specific request for people with specific backgrounds. I do have a couple of questions from individuals who've written in that I want to combine. So they're all about award benefits, really in relation to housing and the host universities. So someone wanted to know if the host institutions pay part of the award cost. The awards to Sub-Saharan Africa, they're funded fully by the U.S. government. The awards to other regions are either funded by the U.S. government or also funded by foreign governments. So we have these in groups called commissions, which are binational groups, which also, I would say probably about a third of the funding to the Fulbright program is given by foreign governments. And about two-thirds is given by the U.S. government. So the host institutions themselves, just to make it very clear, they may provide benefits like a place to work or just research equipment or something like that. You know, the benefits really vary depending on what you're doing and who you're working with. But they do not provide any financial benefits to Fulbright scholars. But housing is a benefit that we generally work with the universities. So we usually partner with universities that can provide housing. So another just follow-up question about housing. I guess could both of you speak about your experience about housing, what it was like? And it can just keep it fairly brief if you'd like, but just to make sure reiterate that, because I think sometimes when we're thinking about these types of grants, we think a lot about what we want to do and, you know, who we're going to work with and not about these more specific logistical things, but it can also be quite useful while we have you both here. Meg, could you start?
Sure. So what we did before is we went and looked up, there wasn't housing at the university for us. And so what we did is we thought, well, it's easier for me to travel farther to the university, and for my husband and kids, it's maybe easier for them to be closer to the school, especially with one car. That would make sense, as well as our daughter went to a small local daycare just a few mornings a week to play with other kids and have some activity for her. So we looked up, we actually Google mapped places and went on, and just looked up rentals online. I mean, it's amazing what you can find online, and people have pictures posted, and you can email. And so we, as soon as we knew that we had the award, we started emailing and looking up locations and how far they were from where I was going to be working and where the school was for the kids to figure out the best place for us. And again, we didn't want something big. We wanted something that was small, manageable. We weren't there for a year. We were there for a shorter period of time. But you also want to be comfortable. We didn't want to have a place where we had to buy things or beds or anything like that. So finding something that at least could be furnished was what we were looking for. And I'm glad that we did that because it allowed us sort of on weekends when things were maybe a little bit slower to have places that we could walk around and be close to the store and things that, so we did, I mean, Google Maps is wonderful and kind of doing some looking online in regards to location was really helpful for us as a family.
Great. What about you, Tanya?
Well, I was in a similar situation in terms of the university not providing any help with housing. They did recommend like a guest house close to their campus where kind of like if they have a visitor for a day or a week, they would stay there, but that wasn't an option, kind of like for us as a family. I did arrive in South Africa a month before my kids arrived, and my colleague, she was really sweet and hosted me at her house for a week and also kind of like drove me around before I had a rental car and we looked at places together. For South Africa, Airbnb has lots of great options. I actually had one that would have worked after the fact. Kind of like now I say I could have also kind of like rented that house through where I made the connection through Airbnb. At the time, I wasn't sure how the whole kind of like driving the kids to school and me going to work and the one car issue would work out, so I was kind of like more focused on an area where there was a shuttle for from the school, which at the end didn't work out. I did send emails to realtors and looked in the internet kind of like, and I specified like the neighborhoods I was interested in, and I got really, really lucky. We found a beautiful three-bedroom house on top of the hill with a gorgeous view. It had everything but a dishwasher. I say that because my son still remembers he had to do the dishes for a year, but there was really like a washing machine, there were bed sheets, there was a housekeeper, a gardener, towels, really like everything you could dream of. And we were very, very happy with that location. It was inside a gated community, but it was also still like it was something you can afford on your Fulbright housing allowance. So I think we paid with electricity and all the extra expenses, we paid still a little less than what we had as the Fulbright housing allowance. It was kind of like it was a little stressful until we found the right place because I was like, oh, the kids are coming in 2 weeks. I still don't have a place. But it was worth checking around, calling around, emailing. You need to send lots of emails. I got a couple of answers back. And I just felt like I won the jackpot.
Oh, well, that sounds really lovely. I love that. And I do want to also note that just from an outreach perspective that we do on our side of it, we generally encourage people, you know, not to think too much on this until they've actually know if they get a grant or not. Of course, it is really up to you, you know, if you'd like to do any research beforehand for this kind of stuff. But it is something, you know, it's good to start thinking about. But really, it's once people get a grant that they can really start looking into this more thoroughly. So with our last few minutes, I just have a couple other questions that I'd love to hear from. For our alumni, and one of them, I think Meg, you already talked about it a little bit, but just to make sure that everyone hears about your experience, because I think it's really great. If you could both describe just the one lasting impact of your Fulbright experience, or if, you know, for example, if you're collaborating, I know Meg, you're still collaborating with the people that you worked with, so that's a great example. But really any other way that Fulbright has made a lasting impact in your life, that would be fantastic. Could we start with you, Meg?
Sure. I'll have to answer, and then I'll probably have to log off because I go back to teaching at 1. I'm teaching a summer class, so I've got to run back up there. I'm always happy to answer any questions that people have or if they want to follow up with me as well. I'm fine with that. I honestly had a fantastic experience, and I don't have any challenges that really, I mean, minor things, but I think the lasting impact, I am very thankful and energized. I think for me as a faculty, energized in the work that's happening internationally and the relationships that I've built in Zambia, to be able to have communication almost on a weekly, bi-weekly basis now with faculty that I started work there with, to know that we've built a trusting relationship, that they like my work, I like their work, and that we are moving forward with other projects now is really exciting to me. So professionally, that's fantastic. And then, again, personally, to see the changes in sort of my family, and now when my kids, when we talk about places in the world, it makes sense to them. It resonates with them that the world is big and people live differently. And there's a whole range out there, and I think that that's really important. My son did a lot of sort of came out with myself and my husband to do different community projects. Something that I think also is important, I'm just going to add this on here, and I hope that's okay, is finding something if you're traveling with a partner, spouse, where they can get involved, I think can be really helpful and sort of an added experience. My husband ended up working with Circus Zambia. That he's an artist, and so he ended up doing a lot of volunteer work with kids that are in a really tough community to use circus as a tool for HIV prevention and education. And so he's a faculty here in theater, and so he was able to use that and be involved. So I think it touched our lives, and my life, both professionally and personally on many, many levels.
Meg, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm so glad that we've had a chance to hear about that and hear about the experience of your husband as well and your family. And I'm glad that it was a positive experience. And I so appreciate you fitting this into your busy schedule. So we will let you go and continue on with your Friday. But have a wonderful weekend, and thank you again for taking the time to share your experience. I found it really beneficial, and I think everyone else did as well.
And as questions come up, I encourage everyone to reach out and ask. I think we've all been there, and it's sort of a one step at a time, figuring it out, and each situation is going to be different, and needs are going to be different, but not being afraid to ask, I think, is really the key, because it is very different. You are getting up and moving your whole world for a little while, but also thinking about the world you're leaving here. I know for me it was planning my home and family and dogs and things that on this end it to be accounted for. So it's a lot of planning, but I think if you just take it one step at a time, it makes a big difference.
Great, thank you. And someone else just wrote, and thank you as well. So thank you from all of us. I really appreciate that. And have a wonderful Friday, Meg. And Tanya, I guess I'll ask you one last final question. It'll be a combo question, just what I asked Meg as well. If you could describe just any lasting impact as well as any advice you could give to, you know, potential applicants, we would love to hear from you as well.
Oh, I regularly wake up in the morning and I look at my cell phone, and there are messages on WhatsApp from both like the teachers I worked with in South Africa, the university faculty I worked with. So my project really still grows and keeps going on beyond the time I was there. And it's just fun. And we're also kind of like, it's a bigger community now. In a way, having been to South Africa and having worked there and combining the work back into what I do at Texas Tech University, also gave my research back in the U.S. Like more importance or more recognition. On a personal perspective, I regularly hear from parents who know my son who came back with us to Texas. He's a freshman in high school now. Like, he's the kid who talks about South Africa a lot. One of his friends gave him like a South African scarf. He wears it like year-round, summer or winter. It's kind of like part of his outfit now. Our daughter, she decided to go and finish high school, like her junior, senior year in Germany, which was kind of like a turnout from the Fulbright, because she went to that German school in South Africa, and it wouldn't have happened without going on that Fulbright. So that's more like on the unanticipated but very positive personal side that life has changed. In general, as advice, well, that letter of kind of like make contact. If you get a good letter of invitation, if you make that contact where somebody is responsive and excited about your project, you've already won most of what you need to accomplish, I feel. That's the toughest part in general. Go where your heart wants to take you. Do that project that you're really enthusiastic about and that you think is important. And yeah, as Meg also said, like a lot of the housing issues or visa or school issues, you can worry about them once you get that letter saying you got the full drive. There also is a pre-departure orientation for sub-Saharan Africa, and a lot of important information will be discussed there on how to find houses, how to travel, visa application, and so forth. So you really don't need to worry about like the logistics until, I would say, start worrying when you make it into stage two of the application process, like your application goes to the home country. Then you can start worrying about, like, what do I do with my house at home? Do I take my family with me? What kind of housing would we want? What preparations in terms of IRB, et cetera, should I do beforehand? But really make it a worthwhile experience by creating, making it that project you're most enthusiastic about, and that's close to your heart.
Thank you so much, Tanya. That is just very inspiring. And I just want to note that you're joining us today from Germany. So we also really appreciate your time and how you and you know just made time for this to talk to people. I'm getting, you know, getting responses from candidates just saying thank you to you personally. So we really appreciate hearing from you, and I'm glad to hear that you had a productive and positive experience as well.
Yeah, also let me just say, like, I'm happy to answer questions by email or via Skype, so you're welcome to forward my email address to anybody who's interested in or has questions about South Africa. And generally, look at Fulbright has a website of former Fulbright awardees in the specific countries, and only these people, like Mac and myself, had a very great experience and are more than happy to help. So don't hesitate to go to that website, kind of like who has been in the region at the university or in the country that I am considering, and ask those people, because they have personal connections and they might make connections for you to where afterwards there's far more responsiveness.
Thank you so much, Tanya. All right, and with that, we will let you go. We really appreciate your time, and just really great hearing from you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. We're a little bit over time, so this will be recorded, but I'm going to take the next 5 minutes and just do some rapid fire of some questions that we haven't gotten to yet from people mostly who wrote in before, but I do want to make sure that we address the questions that specific people asked. So we just have about 10 questions that I'll go through really quickly with my wonderful colleague, Nick. Can you start? All right, so Nick will just ask me some questions, and these are ones that were also submitted by applicants. And again, if you have additional questions that are going on in your head right now, feel free to send me an email. My email address is subsaharanafrica@iu.org, and I'm more than happy to speak to you one-on-one.
All right, thanks, May. So again, my name is Nick Willon. I'm the Outreach and Selection Coordinator here at IIE. First off, we have a question about affiliation with a home institution. So, May, if you are not affiliated with a home institution, how do you recommend sharing your Fulbright experience when you return?
That is a great question. I would say, first of all, that depends on the type of activity that you propose to do. So it's going to be different if you're doing teaching or research, because, of course, you know, there are people who, if they do research, who might be working on a book or publications, as well as teaching, you know, perhaps doing some sort of lectures when they get home in an adjunct capacity or something like that. It really depends on what your project is and the activities that you propose to do there. I always recommend talking to your colleagues to get an idea, you know, how they handled it or what they would do. You can take a look at our Fulbright Scholar Directory if you'd like to reach out to alumni. But yeah, just some quick answers for that. Since we do work with a lot of people who don't have home institutions, just think about, you know, how to get your message out there and the different avenues for that. All right. Thank you so much.
All right, great. So what factors should one consider when choosing a host country at the beginning of their application?
So this, I think, you know, I think it really goes down to what you value. So a lot of times when I start these presentations, I talk about like how it fits in your life. So I'll talk about make sure you look for grants that are just feasible. You know, if you can only take 3 months off, if you can only take a month at a time off, or if you have that capacity to go for longer-term grants, that's really one thing that's going to affect what you apply for. Or if you have a stronger background in teaching or research, you know, a lot of people do teaching research projects, and they want to know advice for that. And my advice would be make sure that both components of the project are really well thought out, that you're not just tacking on a teaching project or teaching on a research project, that you're really thinking through the activities that you want to do and you're playing to your strengths as well as to your future interests. You know, I have postdocs reach out to me all the time who say that they just, you know, need that experience and that's why they want to go on a Fulbright. You know, it's absolutely fine if you are going on a Fulbright and you're bringing your expertise to a country, but you're also doing something that you think will help further your career. So it's just thinking about playing to your strengths, and when you're explaining what you want to do, doing something that's feasible in terms of either the fact that you're able to take off that amount of time. If you're doing a teaching or research project, thinking of, you know, for research, for example, thinking about the number of site visits that you're going to do, and do you have that language ability to do it, or can you hire someone to help with translation? You know, there's so many different factors, but just thinking about something that, you know, as Tanya said, follow your passions, and then I would add to that in a realistic way, but absolutely following what you want to do, and that can really answer a lot of questions that you have, because it's very easy to get really overwhelmed, but if you're just honest with yourself when you're looking through our catalog of award and what fits for you. I am also here to talk you through some stuff if you would ever like to schedule a one-on-one consultation.
So speaking in terms of research awards, what kind, especially for those looking to do research in the sciences, do these opportunities include researching in the social science, or is more emphasis put on hard science projects?
That's a great question. It's going to depend on country to country. I know for South Africa, we have a Social Science and Humanities Award. They're specifically looking for people in the social sciences, and we do have many other awards throughout our catalog. So I'd recommend doing a keyword search in our catalog of awards. Keep it more broad than less broad. So, for example, if you work in chemistry, then I would put chemistry, not that you work in, like, oxides or anything really, really specific. Try to keep it a little bit more broad and do a keyword search that way. And I will say we do have a lot of opportunities for hard sciences, which you will see there's a strong need for that. That doesn't mean that what you do isn't really important. It just means that, you know, they have maybe a lack of education and they want to see more teachers in those fields who have PhDs. It is, I know, for example, with Ethiopia, they don't have a lot of academics who have PhDs teaching some of those hard sciences, and that's a need there, just to be frank. All right, next one, Nick.
So we have one about timeline. So is it possible to go for a summer period, for example, from May to August?
So most of our awards will start June or July. I think the earliest is July 2019. It's really going to depend on the exact award, so it'll say on the award description when they're looking for someone to start. But these awards are fall 2019, spring 2020. The one exception is the Africa Regional Research Program. So that award is something that I would recommend taking a look at if you just don't have that flexibility with your schedule. With our Flex Grant, individuals can propose to go really split their grant between 4 and 6 months, and you could definitely do a summer one there, or potentially going to one country for as little as 3 months, as much as 9 months, and incorporate the summer in there as well. It's just important to also be there when the universities or institutions need you. So it's not just about your schedule. It's also finding collaborators that are looking for someone to come in the summer. So you'll have to look at, just talk to collaborators and see if your schedule fits in with their academic calendar or their summer needs.
Can applicants apply for awards for the following application cycle? For example, if I would like to apply for award opportunity from 2022 to 2023 in Burkina Faso.
I love that you're thinking so far ahead, and honestly, it's quite common. A lot of times, scholars take 3 to 5 years before they actually apply to a grant, so you're not the only one in that boat. Our competition currently, you can apply by August 1st, 2018 for opportunities, as I mentioned, fall 2019, spring 2020. Our next competition will open next spring, so for that following year, and so on. So you'll just have to check back to see when those opportunities are available. I will mention that our awards do change year to year, so while there is just a very strong possibility that you'll have an award available that fits your eligibility if you are a U.S. citizen as well as someone with a terminal degree, it might not be the same award that you originally looked at, or maybe what they're looking for has changed. So if you are someone who is looking at our catalog now but not planning to apply for a few years, then I would recommend, you know, when you are planning on applying, looking back at that catalog of awards and making sure that what you want to do has an opportunity. And again, staff like me and Nick are always here to help navigate, our online resources.
So speaking of the catalog of awards, let's say I have a particular set of skills. Maybe I'm a music theorist or a guitarist. How can I find a place where I'd be the most helpful? How should I approach the host?
Great. So off the top of my head, I can think of three awards which are specifically looking for musicians. So Nigeria and Ethiopia, for example, are looking for someone with a music background. So doing that keyword search can be really helpful. And then from there, talking to individuals at the universities listed on our website is great. There are so many different ways that you can meet collaborators. I know Tanya spoke about meeting someone at a conference and starting that conversation, which I think is such a fantastic way of getting to know someone who has a similar academic background as you. But as well, you know, if you are in a position where you are just looking for someone new, then you can I've mentioned this before, I'm sure, but just to reiterate, look at the university websites, speak to people at the international office at your campus, look at the scholar directory, reach out to people. As you can see, you know, our alumni here today were just so friendly and so encouraging of people reaching out to them. You know, a lot of our other alumni, I'm sure, would be willing to hear from you and connect you if they can, or perhaps just offer advice. And then again, you know, if someone is really struggling to find help, then you can either contact the U.S. Embassy through the catalog of awards or reach out to staff like me, and we can inquire if the U.S. Embassy has any particular recommendations for you.
Okay, so let's say that a potential host college or university that I'm thinking of affiliating with does not teach a course that I would like to lead. So what's the best way to approach that situation?
That's a great question. So, you know, we usually recommend that you reach out to someone in the similar department. If that department doesn't exist, you might want to reach out to similar department heads or someone like an assistant dean or a dean, or even just someone who works at an administrative level who can just help talk with you about possibilities. Or if they would like to grow a program, if they have an interest in a discipline that they may not have. We do have a lot of Fulbright scholars who work with developing new programs at institutions or building the capacity of current programs, so it is certainly not unheard of to develop a new program at an institution. Those initial conversations might be a little bit more difficult, but reaching out to someone who has a similar interest in saying, you know, I'm an expert in XYZ, I notice you don't have that program, you know, are you interested in having that program? Here's my resume, here's the project I'm thinking about. And this is advice I always give specifically to people who are in sub-Saharan Africa, but sometimes people complain to me and they're like, oh, like I sent an email, you know, 4 days ago and I haven't gotten a response. They're clearly not interested in the work that I have to do. I would say that may not be true. So if you If you have the capacity to, I'd recommend following up by phone call if you can. If you're able to find someone's phone number on the internet, then just try to give them a call in their time, in an appropriate time frame. And, you know, don't necessarily give up just because you didn't get an answer immediately. It is different than communicating with people in the U.S., so you have to take that cultural context. And if you're someone who gives up after sending one email, I don't know how to say this diplomatically, but, you know, that's not a great sign because, you know, as you can tell from hearing our alumni speak, you know, you do have to be persistent while you're on grant, even in country. You have to know what you want and figure out how to get there, and don't be afraid to follow up with people. So don't be put off if, you know, an email that you sent wasn't answered. I really wouldn't take it personally, and I would really just think of, okay, how's another way that I can try to communicate with this person? And then if that really doesn't work, then, all right, reach out to, you know, I'll reach out to May at subsaharanafrica@iae.org and tell her I'm having trouble, and I will be more than happy to help you. So just, you know, be creative when you're thinking about this and just, you know, try different options. I'd recommend that would be some of my recommendations. I really could go on if you'd let me, but I do want to be cognizant of that we are very much over time. So is that the last of the questions, Nick? Do we have any more?
We have a couple more if we have one more.
Well, I will keep talking because there's still some people on. But really, since we are so over, I understand if you have lives and this will be recorded.
Yes, very well said. So let's say for those who are not teaching at a university, maybe you're a high school teacher with a PhD and a record of academic publications. What are your chances of getting an award for that kind of candidate?
So that's an interesting question. A lot of our awards, although not all, will give preference to individuals who have specifically postgraduate or university teaching experience. So if you're a high school teacher who doesn't have that experience, I would recommend, but you have a lot of experience with publications, you might want to pursue a research-only route. If you would like to do a teaching and research combination, then I'd recommend looking at different award opportunities that potentially don't specify that they want a preference for a certain candidate. Keeping in mind, though, if you have experience in a certain region or if your background fits with an award really well, then maybe it's okay to still apply for that award and just talk to your strengths. So speak about how your experience would make you the best fit for this award, why it's really important for you to be there in country, and if you have a strong letter of invitation, then that is also something that can really be a benefit as well.
Okay, last question, then we can finish up. So does any opportunity require residence in sub-Saharan Africa? So, for example, if you currently live in South Africa and may return to the United States within the year, how exactly does that work?
So that's an interesting question that I actually haven't heard before. So these opportunities, the Fulbright grant, which, as I mentioned, is really all about mutual exchange, provides opportunities that have to be done in-country. And a huge part of the application process when you're writing a grant is explaining why you need to be in-country to do it. So for this grant, if you don't want to be in-country, I'm not sure that this would be the best award for you or the best program for you, because we are looking for people who want to go abroad and teach and do research. And another thing I would note is just in terms, I would recommend taking a look at our eligibility requirements. If you've lived outside of the U.S. for, I think it's more than 5 out of 6 calendar years, and we define that as a year is 9 months out of 12 months, then you are most likely not eligible. So I would recommend taking a look at our eligibility requirements, and also feel free to follow up with our staff if you have any questions as to what that means. And with that, thank you so much, Nick and Tanya and Meg and all of you wonderful people who took the time to write in and listen to me talk for such a long time. I really appreciate it. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your Friday. And if you have any specific questions about your project or just need help finding an award or having trouble finding a letter of invitation, that's what I'm here for. I'm more than happy to provide additional resources via email or set up a phone call. Thank you so much, and enjoy your Friday.